David Kilcullen, first of all, was Barack Obama right to fire Stanley McChrystal?
I think he really had no choice. And if you understand the sensitivity of the issue of civil control over the military here in the United States, it's a very sensitive issue. And I think he felt that he just couldn't do anything other than fire General McChrystal because of the comments made, mainly by his staff, actually, not the general himself. Most of the military people that I've spoken to in the Pentagon, the Joint Staff, various other places, and forward in Afghanistan since that time have all agreed that, you know, it was the only decision the president could make.
People have made the comparison to General MacArthur, but MacArthur had much bigger ambitions. He had ambitions on the presidency, really, didn't he? I mean, it's not a total parallel.
Well, he also invaded China, you know, without permission, right? I mean, this would be the equivalent of MacArthur would be McChrystal invading Pakistan, you know, so I don't see it as being the same in terms of substance, but it was the same in a sense that the president, who was already under pressure because of the BP oil spill and a variety of other things and people criticizing his leadership, felt that he just couldn't allow those kind of comments to stand, particularly coming from a general who he's already reprimanded twice for kind of loose lips with respect to the media.
What is a general as senior and as experienced as that doing, allowing trash talk in front of a reporter?
Well, that's one issue, and I think it's pretty clear that the staff were acting as if they were off the record. There's been a lot of discussion here in the States about whether, in fact, they were ambushed by the freelance journalist working for Rolling Stone, and there's been some suggestion that they were never given the opportunity to fact-check some of the stuff that they had said.
That is disputed, of course.
Well, yeah, and the second point that I was going to make is, well, great, but so what? Like, even if you shouldn't be saying that stuff in front of a journalist, even if you think you're off the record, and without wanting to compare because it's a different environment, but I was on General Petraeus's personal staff in Iraq. Never in a million years would we have said stuff like that to each other, even if there wasn't a media person in the room, and let alone in front of a reporter. I think it was a, you know, an interesting team dynamic issue, as well as the issue of media relations that we're looking at here.
Does it say anything about the strategy and tactics? Does it say anything about putting somebody who was essentially a special forces guy and therefore not necessarily attuned to conventional warfare in many forms in charge?
I'm not sure is the short answer to that. General McChrystal and I worked reasonably closely over the last year in Afghanistan. I was a consultant to NATO, and I think that he understands counterinsurgency much better than most conventional generals. He really did have a deep understanding of what needed to be done. He had a very good relationship with the relevant Afghans. He understood how to fight the war, but his difficulty was in communicating that to the 40-odd nations in the mission in such a way that the troops on the ground understood it. And in fact, the bit in the article which I think is most telling is the discussion between McChrystal and some troops on the ground in the field who just aren't convinced that the rules of engagement are working and aren't convinced that the mission's working.
They want permission to kill more people.
Well, I think the troops' frustration comes about from concern that they don't have the situational awareness to distinguish good guys from bad guys, and they feel they've been artificially limited from protecting themselves. Now, in point of fact, that's not the policy, and McChrystal's been very clear about that on numerous occasions. Explaining and training and learning how to do it in a slightly different way are very different from just saying what the policy is. And I think that's the sort of lost in translation aspect of this.
The message, as in many large institutions, gets diluted or distorted on the way down.
Yeah. And this is a large institution that is under an incredible pressure and is composed of 40 different national groups, many of whom don't have a common language, and is scattered all over the country and not able to communicate very well. So it's a particularly difficult organizational change issue that General McChrystal took on when he took command.
In Iraq, he became deeply respected by the troops for taking on al-Qaeda very successfully. Did he misunderstand the problem in Afghanistan because he thought he was going for a similar enemy, and is the enemy actually different?
Well, I think the enemy is very different, but I think General McChrystal very much understood that. And I think if you'd asked me last week, list for me the main problems in Afghanistan. Look, we have some very serious problems there, but General McChrystal wasn't one of them. He certainly understood what was going on. I think this is a relatively straightforward case of the general's staff getting him in trouble with the media at a time when the president just could not tolerate that kind of behavior. And he was fired for basically a breach of etiquette rather than for a failure in policy. Now, you can argue that actually the policy does have problems and ought to be changed, but that's not why he was fired.
There's real substance in the article as well, though. It's not just about media relations. In particular, I'm thinking about the revelations in it about the relations with Karzai and the idea, for instance, that Karzai was napping and wouldn't be disturbed at the beginning of a very important operation, which he had to sign off on.
This gets back to the issues in the campaign, and I think President Karzai's behaviour all through this year and the Pakistanis' behaviour this year has been very heavily influenced by the president's speech last December, in which he laid out a timeline and said that we would commence pulling back from Afghanistan around the middle of next year. And almost immediately that statement was made, people in Afghanistan, from the president down, President Karzai down, started hedging and covering their bases. That was around the time that President Karzai first put peace feelers out to the Taliban. He talked about rejoining the Taliban. He started criticizing the international community and criticizing the United States. He fired the two most competent members of his cabinet, who also both happened to be completely unacceptable to the Taliban as negotiating partners. So I think you can understand Karzai's behavior throughout this year as the rational actions of a man who thinks we're leaving and thinks he has a limited amount of time to make a deal and is desperate to get to a point where he can deal with the Taliban before it's too late. And in the case of the Kandahar offensive, McChrystal goes over there to wake him up and get him to take responsibility for a military invasion of the Taliban heartland, which also happens to be his hometown, where his brother lives, and he doesn't want to take responsibility for it. So the guy, quote-unquote, can't be woken from his nap. I don't think the problem is President Karzai's sleeping habits. The problem is we've put him in a position where he can't back us as he might want to, because he feels like we're leaving.
What's the alternative, though, for an American president? Isn't it just giving an open-ended commitment, which the electorate will interpret as we're staying forever?
You can look at the handling of that timeline in a number of different ways. And, you know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have a deadline. You must definitely have a deadline in your own mind. But it's communicating that deadline in a very public way to everybody that has created this kind of problem. Now, we've walked back from it by saying it's conditions-based and it's only going to be a small withdrawal and it depends on the situation on the ground, all those sorts of things. But unfortunately, Afghans didn't hear that. And I was in Afghanistan when the speech was made, and they certainly heard it as, we have 18 months before the Americans leave. And what it reminded them of was the Gorbachev period in the Soviet-Afghan war, where he gave the same amount of time, 18 months, to General Gromov to win the war. Otherwise, the Russians were going to leave. And, of course, that was the bloodiest period of the Soviet-Afghan war. So people responded to it in a different way in Afghanistan from other places.
So we can see that there's a real crisis to be dealt with. The man now given the task of dealing with that crisis is General Petraeus. You know him very well. You've worked very closely with him. How is he likely to be able to take it on in a way that's different, better than General McChrystal?
Firstly, I think he's very, very good at communicating to a wide variety of people how to do this stuff properly. And that was one of his great strengths in Iraq, that he was able to take again, fairly diverse multinational force and have them all singing from the same sheet of music about how to do the operations very, very quickly. You might shorthand that as the ability to stamp his personality on the force. The second factor is that in Iraq in particular, and also in his job as CENTCOM commander, Petraeus has been extremely good at the political level, and in particular at working closely with governments like the Iraqi government to force them to take the action they need to take in order to stabilize the environment. A lot of the instability in Afghanistan arises from Afghan government behavior. And one of the problems in our conduct of the war to date has been this unwillingness to hold the Afghan government's feet to the fire and say, no, this abuse and corruption has to stop, otherwise we won't be able to stabilize the country. In Iraq, General Petraeus, again, it's not widely known, but actually General Odierno did most of the manoeuvring of forces on the ground. He was the corps commander under General Petraeus. Petraeus spent hours every night in conversation with Maliki, the president of Iraq, essentially bullying, cajoling, persuading, convincing him to do everything that had to be done to make it work. I'm hoping that he's going to take a similar close engagement approach with President Karzai, and I think that could make a big difference.
You make it very clear in your book that it's not all going to be about the central government, that the problem is very much spread around the country, and that the actions have to be taken on a very local level, on a very personal level in some cases. Is that going to improve?
I think it's already improving, actually. I wouldn't count that as one of the problems right now. I think in the last 6 months or so, we've seen a real push into district level and even sub-district level governance by the coalition forces. And we've seen the emergence of something that's currently called the Village Stabilization Program, which is the use of working with local communities, use of special forces to work with local communities in a sort of neighborhood watch way. It's a little bit like what happened with the Sunnis and the awakening in Iraq. It has yet to develop the same momentum, but it's early days yet. So I think we're getting it on the security front. The issue is getting it on the governance and corruption side, and that is and always has been the weakest part of the campaign.
You're in Washington, D.C. at the moment. You must have a feel for the way that the tide is moving on this. From here, it looks as though it's turning rather strongly against the war at the moment. Can General Petraeus work fast enough and effectively enough to get things done in such a way as to turn the tide back?
Well, I think there are two points there. Firstly, I think from the outside looking in, it probably seems more of a crisis in the States than it actually is. People here are mainly worried about the economy and unemployment, those kinds of issues. And Afghanistan's been very much a back burner issue until recently. The BP oil spill has been dominating the news here almost continuously for the last 2 months and has been probably the biggest issue that people criticize the president for over lack of leadership. Some people have likened it to Obama's Hurricane Katrina. I think that's vastly overstated, but it certainly has meant that Afghanistan hasn't been a front burner issue. As of this week, because of what happened with McChrystal, it is now a front burner issue. But I don't think Americans are ready to throw in the towel. I think they don't like the war, but people see it in a very different light from Iraq. They saw Iraq as embarrassing and a mistake. They see Afghanistan as an unpleasant necessity, and I think that does make a difference. And I think, finally, all of these things in Afghanistan are problems. The only thing that makes them a crisis is next year's deadline. And to the extent that that can become conditions-based and that some flexibility can be built into that, I think there's a lot more wiggle room to make it stable than if you treat it as sort of a hard start time for withdrawal.
One of your rules, I suppose, is that the mistakes of counterinsurgency become the lessons of the next generation, if you like. What do you think are the lessons of Afghanistan?
I think the fundamental lesson is that we completely misinterpreted our success in 2001 and have failed to maintain the partnership with the Afghans that allowed us to conquer the country from the Taliban so quickly in 2001. You may remember it took about 7 weeks to completely throw the Taliban out, and the last Taliban stronghold was Kandahar, and it fell on the 7th of December 2001. On the morning that Kandahar fell, there were only 110 CIA officers and about 350 coalition special forces in the southern part of Afghanistan. And so some people said, well, what allowed us to win was a small number of special forces on the ground and massive air power and satellite-based surveillance and all those sorts of capabilities. Well, that's completely missing the point, because in addition to those guys, there were 50,000 Afghans fighting on our side against the Taliban. And I would suggest that the secret of our success in 2001 wasn't the brilliance of our technology. It was that we had the Afghans on our side and a very substantial part of the Afghan population supporting the effort. That partnership has been very gravely damaged over the last 8 years of continued promises and failure to deliver.
Irreparably?
And I don't know, and I don't think we're going to know until we actually see how the next 12 months pays out. But I think that's the critical issue. We've got to try to restore that partnership with the Afghans based on mutual confidence. If we can't restore that, then it really, no amount of military effort is going to get us there.
We saw in Northern Ireland just the other day how Bloody Sunday, the result of it lasted for 38 years, really. That was an operation which used all the wrong counterinsurgency techniques at a time when others in the province were trying the right kind. But that one mistake was enough to intensify the troubles for the next 30 years. It's an indication, isn't it, of how long-lasting and how damaging a mistake can be.
It is, and interestingly, one of the things about Northern Ireland that's most relevant here is the Good Friday Accords of 1998. And in the book that you mentioned, which is my second book on counterinsurgency, I've taken a very large end perspective and looked at the 380-odd counterinsurgency campaigns that have happened in the last 200 years. And one of the interesting things about that large body of data is, firstly, that governments usually win. In about 80% of cases, the insurgents lose. But if you look at that 80% where the government wins, almost always the government's fighting in its own country and it's willing to make some kind of serious political deal with the insurgency. And the Good Friday Accords are a very good example of that in 1998, where the IRA basically agreed to put the weapon down in return for a seat at the table, be part of the political process. If you look at most successful counterinsurgencies, they end in an agreement, something like a Good Friday Agreement. So, I mean, we were criticizing President Karzai for wanting to negotiate earlier. In itself, there's nothing wrong with negotiating. In fact, most successful counterinsurgencies end in a negotiation, and Northern Ireland is a classic example of that. But you've got to be negotiating from a position of strength, and right now we're not in a position of strength.
We know now that in Northern Ireland, the British government, for many years when it was saying that it would never negotiate, was actually negotiating on the back channel. Is that the way to do it?
In fact, it's not only something that happened in Northern Ireland. Again, if you take that large end perspective, it happens in pretty much every counterinsurgency, that there will be clandestine negotiations for a while, and then open negotiations, and then finally some kind of peace deal. I would be very surprised if we're not in some kind of informal or formal negotiation process with the Taliban by this time next year. It probably won't be that part of the Taliban that's aligned with Al-Qaeda. It will probably be the Pashtun nationalist component, which is a pretty significant part of the insurgency. But I think we will start that process of debate at some point.
But from a public point of view, an elector's point of view, that means negotiating with people who chop off people's heads for dancing or watching television, stop women going to school, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the harsh realities of counterinsurgency that you do have to make deals with people in order to put the violence aside. And we got a lot of criticism for this in Iraq, and people said, well, you're doing this reconciliation process with people that have been fighting Americans. And General Petraeus' response was, well, you don't reconcile with your friends.
Yeah.
You know, you reconcile with your enemies. So that's what you do, you know, and if you don't like it, then prepare for another 50 years of fighting, because that's your alternative.
Now, you've said that the future's really difficult to predict in Afghanistan. It's not at all sure that the NATO forces will win. Is it worth the candle?
I think people do tend to get very focused on Afghanistan. The instability in Pakistan matters because it's making Afghanistan unstable. Of course, the reverse is the case. Afghanistan matters primarily because it destabilizes Pakistan. And Pakistan has, you know, 165 million people, 100 nuclear weapons, an army the size of the US Army, and Al-Qaeda headquarters sitting there in the one-third to two-thirds of the country that the government doesn't control. So I think that we do need to think about Afghanistan in the context of a broader regional stability dynamic. Why do the Taliban matter? They matter because they make the place unstable, too unstable to leave. Everybody wants to leave Afghanistan. The question is, how do you make it stable enough that you can leave?